The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jory Slodke for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Discover. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the May-June 2024 issue. We begin with our cover story, Everything Worth Knowing About Neanderthals. A brutal relative of ours, or underrated genius of prehistoric times. Recent and sometimes controversial research sheds a new light. When European archaeologists and anthropologists started stumbling across the first Neanderthal fossils almost two centuries ago, they couldn't imagine that they had discovered a distinct species. Their initial investigations inspired them to think that they had identified some of the oldest specimens of Homo sapiens in Europe. It wasn't until years later that they realized the remains represented another species altogether, completely separate from our own. The low, long shape of the species' skull and the short, stubby build of the species' body were initially interpreted as indications that Homo neanderthalensis, named after sites in Germany's Neander Valley, where some of the specimens were first found, were neither intelligent nor innovative, despite the fact that some of these first fossils were buried beside stashes of stone tools. Neanderthals were swiftly branded as a species of brutes. In actuality, though, they were surprisingly smart and versatile. Some researchers say that the Neanderthals' unique anatomy allowed the species to survive the coldest conditions of the Ice Age in Eurasia. That includes their tall noses, supposedly shaped for warming the air that they inhaled, according to a Proceedings of the Royal Society B study from 2018. Along with their ability to withstand the cold, they sported a whole assortment of adaptive behaviors, making them much more advanced than their early discoverers were probably willing to admit. From the origin of the species around 600,000 years ago to their disappearance 40,000 years ago, it appears that the Neanderthals spent their time in small itinerant tribes. Composed of all ages and sexes, these tribes are thought to have contained around 10 to 30 individuals, according to spatial analyses of Neanderthal sites and genetic analyses of Neanderthal DNA. That said, some studies have suggested that they also gathered in much more substantial groups, with a 2023 study in Science speculating that the hunting of massive terrestrial mammals may have sustained tribes of Neanderthals numbering in the hundreds. Never prone to staying in the same place, the smaller, more mobile tribes bounced between several sites according to the season. As they traveled, they almost certainly came into contact with other Neanderthals, with whom they could share similar skill sets. And those skills were more advanced than early researchers thought, ranging from the tools they made to controlling fire. Researchers also show that art, speech, and perhaps even sailing were possible for Neanderthals, who shared wisdom among themselves, and possibly with our Homo sapiens ancestors. First, fires. The ability to use fire forever changed the fate of our species. For starters, it allowed our ancestors to cook food, which made them much more efficient eaters. Instead of gnawing on nuts and berries all day, they could now cook animal meat, which packs much more of a caloric punch. They also used fire to make more effective weapons and tools. But there's a lot we don't know about humans' early encounters with fire and its transition into effective everyday use. What we do know is that Homo sapiens weren't the only hominins who fanned flames. Early humans were at least aware of fire, about 2 million years ago, well before the arrival of modern humans, says John Gowlett, an archaeologist at the University of Liverpool in the UK, who specializes in the origins of human fire use. This was around the time of Homo erectus, the first hominin with modern human proportions. At first, early humans were fire foragers, meaning that they knew fire could be beneficial. When they encountered it on the landscape, they would watch or follow it, Gowlett says. After stumbling across a wildfire, these early humans might have revisited the site to see what nature had cooked up for them. The evidence for the ability of early human ancestors to make fire for themselves, on the other hand, appears around 800,000 years ago, or even as early as 1.5 million years ago. It's around that time that hominins began to cook and to gather around fires. None of these first fire starters were Homo sapiens, nor were they Homo neanderthalensis, which were not yet present in the archaeological record. When they did appear, however, both species showed similar skill in cooking, says Filippi Natalio, an archaeologist at the Weizmann Institute of Science in Israel. Neanderthals tended to their flames in Europe, and modern humans fed fires in Africa from around 400,000 to 300,000 years ago. When the two species came together in the Levant region, says Natalio, both were seasoned experts in applying flame to their food. Additionally, archaeologists have found evidence of sophisticated tools made using fire. At one Israeli archaeological site, a population of Homo sapiens, Homo neanderthalensis, or some other species, used flames to fortify their blades around 400,000 to 200,000 years ago. By this time, they had also learned to control the temperature of the fire so their tools wouldn't explode in the direct heat. As modern archaeological technology continues to evolve, scientists can look further and further back in the human history of fire. According to both Gowlett and Natalio, archaeologists continue to find sites that show that human fires have been burning a lot longer than previously thought. What did Neanderthals make? We know that the Neanderthals were talented makers. They used a sophisticated array of scrapers and blades, which they fashioned out of stone and other materials. And though Neanderthals were once portrayed as basic and brutish, scientists are now stressing a new narrative. This species was, in its way, as innovative and creative as our own ancestors. Here's a look at what Neanderthals could make. Stone tools. It's no secret that Neanderthals fashioned sophisticated stone flakes, tools with flat faces and thin, sharp sides. To form these flakes, they selected small chunks of stone, also called cores, and trimmed their sides until they took the shape of tortoise shells, flat on one side and spherical on the other. They then smashed the tops of the trimmed stones with a single blow, spitting out sharpened flakes of a standard shape and size, perfect for cutting, carving, and scraping. Studies say that the tool-making practices associated with the Neanderthals included the shaping of over 60 forms of flakes, all fit for specific functions. And though the species wielded some of these tools without any additional shaping and sharpening, they also modified many others into more sophisticated, more specialized implements, including saws and spear points. Some Neanderthal tools were actually set into handles and secured with ties and adhesives. Bone tools. Sharpened stones weren't alone in the Neanderthal toolbox. A 2023 study in PLOS One found that Neanderthals also fashioned implements out of bone, once seen as a solely Homo sapiens skill, for the purpose of butchering animals and preparing hides. Evidence for this has arisen from several Neanderthal sites of note, such as the Chagirskaya cave in the Altai Mountains in Siberia, where about 1,200 bone tools were recently revealed. Researchers theorize that some 50,000 to 60,000 years ago, Neanderthals used the site to process a wide range of animals, including reindeer, horses, and bison, during the cold season. As they cleaned off bones harvested from the large-hoofed animals, Neanderthals fashioned them into tools, including a large number of retouchers to sharpen or shape stone implements, and at least one rounded tool similar to a present-day leather-working instrument. This would have come in handy while processing hides. Clothing. The creation of tools for preparing and piercing holes in hides indicates, according to some studies, that the Neanderthals made clothing. Adding to this assertion are recent finds of Neanderthal fiber technology. In 2020, researchers published a paper in Scientific Reports about a single strand of twisted free frass from a Neanderthal site in France. Though the 50,000-year-old strand only amounts to a 3-ply tangle of fibers, the team says that the twine may indicate a broader industry of string making. Twisted fibers provide the basis for clothing, rope, bags, nets, mats, boats, etc., which, once discovered, would have become an indispensable part of daily life, the researchers report in their paper. Art. Even more impressive are the claims that Neanderthals and modern humans showed similar capabilities in the creation of art. Researchers, published in 2018 in Science Advances, showed that Neanderthal art in the form of pigmented and perforated shells dates to around 115,000 years ago. While primitive, the shells are an indication of culture and the species sophistication that comes with it. Other studies suggest Neanderthals worked with pigments to make rudimentary paint that they used on cave walls to depict a variety of shapes and handprints. In a 2022 analysis of caves in Spain indicates that Neanderthals also may have decorated their dwelling places with animal skulls. Boats? Some researchers also argue that sailing was not the sole domain of Homo sapiens. Yet, in the absence of specific artifacts, much of the evidence for earlier seafaring efforts remains indirect, says Bruce Hardy, chair of the Department of Anthropology at Kenyon College in Ohio. Most of it has to do with the fact that you have human occupation on islands that were never connected by land anywhere, at any point, even when we have lower sea levels, says Hardy. You either have to postulate that you've got natural rafts drifting and leading to human occupation of some of these islands, or you've got to have an intentional movement to the islands, which is going to have to involve some kind of watercraft. The strongest support for this idea comes from 100,000-year-old Neanderthal or Homo erectus tools on Greek islands, including Crete, which lies about 25 miles from the mainland. The suggestion is that a population of Neanderthals or Homo erectus may have island hopped. Other researchers posit that Neanderthals could have sailed the Aegean as far back as 130,000 years ago, also based on the discovery of stone tools. It's a controversial theory with further investigations needed. Another possibility exists that Neanderthals and Homo erectus drifted to islands atop natural vegetation mats, says Hardy, but in his view, there's enough evidence out there that you really have to admit that boats are involved at some point. Could Neanderthals speak? With their tools, art, and control of fire, it's increasingly difficult to see the achievements of the Neanderthals as all that different from the achievements of our own ancestors. Adding to that difficulty is recent research into Neanderthal speech. In 2021, researchers at University of Binghamton in New York State and Universidad de Alcalá in Spain discovered that Neanderthals had auditory and speech capacities similar to modern-day humans. Drawing on CT scans and 3D models of the ear structures of both Homo neanderthalensis and Homo sapiens, the findings are a further indication that we share more similarities with Neanderthals than scientists previously thought. While fossilized footprints and food scraps have hinted that Neanderthals were competent social creatures, how they communicated with one another remained a mystery. The 1989 discovery of a Neanderthal hyoid, a horseshoe-shaped structure in the throat that's also known as a lingual bone, led to the suspicion that the species had the ability to speak. However, due to the different shapes of the Homo neanderthalensis and Homo sapien larynxes, the theory was dismissed. Now, the new study confirms that Neanderthals used their hyoid in a similar way to modern humans, namely as a support structure for the tongue. So, how did researchers reach the conclusion that the Neanderthals heard and made more than just caveman grunts? High-resolution CT scans of fossilized inner ear structures helped the team create virtual 3D models that resembled Neanderthal ears. They then ran the models through a series of computer simulations and found that the models were able to recognize sounds between 4 and 5 kilohertz, the frequency range for most modern human speech. The range of frequencies recognized by the model also indicated that Neanderthal vocalizations likely included increased use of consonants rather than vowels. though it is now confirmed that these species could perceive and produce a wide variety of sounds, it is still unclear whether these sounds constituted actual speech. Did they coexist with modern humans? When modern humans entered Europe, they didn't drive the continent's other occupants out. Not immediately, anyway, meaning that there was a period in which Homo sapiens and Homo neanderthalensis inhabited Europe at around the same time. But Europe is a big place, and specialists still struggle to answer questions about when and where these two species interacted with one another. A 2022 study in Scientific Reports set out to pinpoint when and where these interactions occurred, if they occurred at all. Analyzing over 60 ancient artifacts crafted by modern humans and Neanderthals, the study found that these species likely lived together in a swath of France and Spain for as much as 2,900 years. To arrive at their findings, the researchers assessed more than 60 tools and personal ornaments from nearly 20 sites across France and Spain. They then used computational modeling to approximate the earliest and latest dates that the artifacts might have been made, as well as the earliest and latest dates that the ancient humans who fashioned the artifacts might have lived in the area. According to this modeling, Homo sapiens appeared in the region between 42,653 and 42,269 years ago, whereas Homo neanderthalensis disappeared from the region between 40,870 and 39,798 years ago. This would mean that the two species roamed the area for a period of around 1,400 to 2,900 years. Though the research reveals a substantial period of regional cohabitation between the two species, the results do not necessarily prove that they interacted with one another within that time. That being said, the researchers say that the similarities between the analyzed artifacts could potentially indicate the sharing of ideas between the two species, an ancient meeting of minds more than a battle between brute and brain. Buried treasure. How long do seeds retain their ability to sprout? One of the world's longest-running experiments examines the mystery. They gathered in secret in the dead of night. To find their way, they consulted a map originally drawn more than a century earlier, counting paces and triangulating their position with compasses. When they reached what they hoped was the right spot, they began to dig. It sounds like something from a movie, but it's a scene that's played out over and over in real life, and will again in about 17 years. The treasure hunters are a group of scientists at Michigan State University, taking part in one of the world's longest-running experiments. Instead of a chest of gold, their treasure is a vault of seeds buried in 1879. Their ongoing mission, passed down through the years, is to answer a seemingly simple question. How long do seeds retain the ability to grow? Technically speaking, a seed is a plant embryo wrapped, along with the reserve of food, in a protective coating. It's also a tiny bundle of potential, a blade of grass, a fragrant flower, a towering tree, neatly packaged and waiting until the conditions are right to grow. But seeds can't wait around forever. After a while, they lose the ability to sprout. They're strange because their job is to stay exactly the same until they transform. It makes it really tricky to study them because the best test we have for whether or not a seed can germinate is by trying to germinate it, says Margaret Grace Fleming, an assistant professor at MSU's Department of Plant, Soil, and Microbial Sciences. The question of seed longevity interested Professor William J. Beale, who was hired at Michigan State University in 1870. MSU, or as it was then known, the State Agricultural College, had an extension program called the Farmers Institute, in which scientists from the college would meet with farmers to share the latest news in agricultural science and answer the farmers' questions. One of the big questions in agriculture that's always been an issue is weeds, says Frank Teluski, professor and director emeritus of the W.J. Beale Botanical Garden and Campus Arboretum at MSU. I can see where farmers would be asking Professor Beale, how long do we have to keep weeding our fields in order to get rid of these pesky weeds and increase our crop efficiency? Essentially, they wanted to know how long weed seeds already in the ground would continue to wreak havoc on new crops. To answer this question, Beale devised an experiment. In the fall of 1879, He gathered 10 glass bottles and filled each of them with sandy Michigan soil containing 50 seeds of 23 common wheats. He then buried them 20 inches deep, with the bottles open and slanted downward to allow for gas exchange, but prevent water from collecting. In doing so, he isolated them while replicating the conditions experienced by seeds buried underground. Then he waited. In 1884, he dug up the first bottle and attempted to sprout the seeds. The results varied wildly from species to species. Of the 50 shepherd's purse seeds, all 50 germinated, as did 45 curled dock, 38 evening primrose, 26 stinking chamomile, and 3 water pepper. On the other hand, none of the ragweed, black mustard, spotted spurge, arbor vitae, corn cockle, rye brome, American burnweed, or broadleaf plantain seeds sprouted. Beale continued his experiment for the next 3 decades, digging up a bottle every 5 years and documenting which seeds grew. When he retired in 1910, he handed the project off to a colleague, Henry Townsend Darlington. Darlington noticed that the same seeds tended to sprout at every 5-year interval and saw an opportunity. He said, "This is really great, but instead of every 5 years, why don't we move it to every 10 years, and we'll stretch this experiment out and see what happens," says Tulewski. As the project continued to move along to new generations of scientists, they continued to see the same usual suspects germinating. In 1980, with 6 bottles then remaining, the MSU faculty voted to extend the interval to 1 bottle every 20 years. The experiment is set to continue through 2100. Tulewski remembers reading news stories about the 1980 bottle being unearthed. "I was just a lowly graduate student, starting a PhD in botany," Tulewski says. He recalls thinking, "This is really neat. What a great experiment. But I never even thought or even dreamt that I would be involved." By the time the year 2000 rolled around, though, Tulewski had taken a position at MSU, and one of his senior colleagues, Jan Zievert, invited him to join the experiment. "I was just gobsmacked," recalls Tulewski. "On a fine spring day in 2000, Jan and I met on campus and we excavated a bottle. They were able to generate 23 sprouts of verbascum, a tall, spiky plant with pale flowers, also known by the common name mullein, as well as one Malva rotundifolia, a mallow plant with rounded leaves." In 2017, Tulewski began recruiting a younger generation of scientists to take up the experiment for him after he retired. His timing, it turned out, underlined the importance of multiple collaborators on the project. Just months after recruiting one of his new partners, David Lowry, Tulewski had a stroke. As he recovered, he and Lowry discussed their hopes for the project. "We started talking about how do we bring the Beale experiment into the 21st century," says Tulewski. "What kinds of questions can we ask? What technologies do we have that we didn't have before? What areas of science are going to be really interested in this besides just the simple question of longevity and weedy species?" With these questions in mind, they recruited 3 more partners, Lars Brodvig, Marjorie Weber, and Margaret Fleming. These scientists brought with them research experience in restoring landscapes to their original flora and fauna, examining how ecological relationships influence evolution, and studying the molecular biology behind seeds' metabolic activities. The new recruits' first encounter with the Beale seeds was delayed a year by COVID-19, but on a snowy night in April of 2021, they set out to retrieve the 5th-to-last bottle. The mission took place in the wee hours, both to prevent the seeds from getting exposed to sunlight that could trigger germination, and to keep the bottle's location hidden and undisturbed. "We all arrived at our meeting spot, and we were feeling so clandestine about it. It was like being in a secret society," says Fleming. In keeping with the then 142-year-old experiment, the means of finding the bottles was charmingly old school. "It's basically a treasure map," says Fleming. "We had to triangulate where the hole would be based on counting paces from landmarks and the intersection of lines. After half an hour of searching in the cold and dark, they began digging, and before long, their shovels hit the walls of the concrete vault containing Beale's bottles. Back in the lab, they emptied out the bottles and placed the seeds in climate-controlled growth chambers, in beds of sterile soil to ensure that no new contaminants were sprouting instead of the 142-year-old Beale seeds. A week later, right on schedule, the first baby verbascum plants poked through. Overall, 20 verbascum seeds sprouted. It's not clear why verbascum seeds are so long-lived. The answer may lie in their permeable seed coats that allow in a small amount of water, but Fleming says, we truly have no idea. It's one of many questions that she and her colleagues hope to answer in the coming decades of research. To help unravel the mysteries of seed longevity, the researchers are turning to a variety of tools and disciplines that Beal never even dreamed of, including analyses of the plant's genomes and proteins. We're going to do Beal 2.0, which is just replacing Beal's experiment just as he set it up. But this time, we have some idea of when certain species are going to die, and we could do sampling around those times and look for what's deteriorating, what kinds of things are changing. Are the proteins more messed up, or is the RNA? Is it something else, says Fleming? The team has also set up a series of community science projects to gather more data points about seed behavior in different places besides East Lansing. I figure that turning to the community would be more expedient than me going around and burying seeds at different places. And this way, we can get, hopefully, worldwide participation, says Fleming. The version of the experiment adapted for non-scientists doesn't rely on a plot of land to lie undisturbed for centuries, though. People can send in their observations after just a few months. Fleming also hopes that to get long-term data, schools could get involved and treat the seed project like a time capsule. To sign up, visit https://citsci.org/projects/seed-burial-experiment. As for the original Beal experiment, four bottles remain underground, waiting to be studied. Tulusky has since retired after unearthing the 2021 bottle, but he hopes to join the 2040 dig as a spectator. You've got this experiment that has been so dutifully taken care of and stewarded by all these previous scientists, and the baton has been passed to you to run this leg, he says. It's really fascinating, and it's really rewarding. Again, to sign up for this experiment, visit https://citsci.org/projects/seed-burial-experiment. Science Story of the Year response. What was the biggest science story of the year for you? I think without question, it was the emergence of AI technology. When the year started, I don't think anyone was thinking about it. Now a day doesn't go by without seeing a news article, podcast, or radio coverage about what's going on with AI. Each year we hold a prediction party, and one of the questions is what category of science will have the biggest story of the year. Only one person correctly guessed that it would be technology this year. We've run out of time for today's episode of Discover. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jory Slodke, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Discover is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call area code 919-832-5138. That number again is area code 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.